Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 612. The Fun Comfortable Tour is on. Well, it's on starting January 16th. I'm doing, I think, 16 dates so far and a lot of cities. Second shows have been added in cities like Chicago and Boston and Seattle and Portland. There's a bunch of other cities too. Vancouver, Denver, Milwaukee, Madison, New York. Go to funcomfortabletour.com and come on out. This episode was incredibly special for me because it's Henry Winkler. And, I mean, you know, not just the Fonz, but Night Shift was a movie that was very, very, very much a part of my young comedy development. And I adore this man. And I'd always heard he was one of the nicest people that you could ever hope to meet. And I can confirm to you that he is... We showed up to his house. He gave us cake. He introduced us to his family. He told us some amazing stories. He shared some wisdom. He's so warm. Do you know what he's doing with his life now? I'm going to tell you one of the things he's doing with his life besides acting. He started a book series a handful of years back called the Hank Zipser series. It's available now. You can buy it wherever books are sold. And this book series is devoted to teaching people who suffer from dyslexia how to read, how to comprehend, how to learn. He's made it fun and funny. What I only recently learned is that he found out quite late in life, actually, that he had dyslexia. And so now it's his life's mission to make sure that no one feels ashamed and that people learn in a fun way how to read who happen to have dyslexia. So this guy is just like, you just want to like wrap him up and just put him in your home and be like, please just hug me, Henry Winkler. I wouldn't recommend that you do that. That's technically kidnapping, but spiritually you might want to do that. But on Twitter, you should throw him some tweet hugs. His Twitter handle is H Winkler, the number 4 and then real. And here we go. There's podcast number. Oh. And it was my birthday party that night. And there was a very special birthday thing that happened in this podcast. And when I'm thinking about it, still kind of melts my brain. So here we go. Nerds Podcast number 612 with Mr. Henry Winkler.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Put that there. It's empty, so nothing will spill. Henry Winkler, we're in your home, which is we were just describing as gorgeous.
It's a Cape Cod.
Yes, in the middle of Los Angeles.
In the middle of Los Angeles. I came here on May 5th, about 16 years ago, and knocked on the door because I heard that it was for sale, and I wanted to beat everybody else. Because we were living in a house I hated. The other house that we were living in, I had rooms. I never went in. And for me, I can't have underwear I don't wear. I feel guilty.
Yeah.
So we were in that house. So I came here. It was pouring rain, and the dining room behind us, which is now covered in oyster plates.
Okay.
They are Majolica oyster plates.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. The wall is covered with them, but that room, which we actually have not used except to place desserts on the table.
And so, eat oysters off the wall.
And eat oysters off the wall. And you know what? They slide right off.
It's not a good idea.
Into your throat.
But, oh, yeah. That is a good idea.
Yeah.
The shell stays there, though. So.
You know, we glue the shell, onto the plate.
It can't be too healthy, but it just looks,
I'm
just
telling
tastes
you,
better that way.
Yes, it's true. And then oysters Rockefeller are just out of the question. But anyway, that room was the old woman's bedroom because she couldn't get upstairs.
Oh.
Yeah, of course, the listener cannot see. There's a big round table. I found out early on with children and guests, you don't want a long table.
Right.
You need a round table if you're going to have a family meal.
Just so you can all see each other.
See each other, pass each other, talk to each other.
So this... So the image of Henry Winkler at the end of a long table where everyone's at the far end of the table and you're just pounding your fist in a
dank
room.
Well, I sit above the salt.
Okay, good, good, good. I just want to make sure.
Yeah. So I'm there alone by choice.
Good,
that's
good,
on
good.
A long
okay,
table.
Great.
And yeah. I want to tell you, when I go to a place that has a long table, I take my own salt.
You have to. You have to.
Yeah. But I'm not interested in having much of a conversation.
Not
on a long table.
You know, eating is functional. You need to get it done and then get back to being away from people.
Now, we're coming up on Thanksgiving. Am I allowed to say that?
Of course.
Okay, so we're coming up on Thanksgiving, which is my absolute favorite meal of all time.
Of course it is.
Okay. So, you know, when you have a meal and there are lots of people who come, I would say we have about 60 people at a table out on the lawn here in the back of the house. People who have nowhere to go. They come. Okay. And usually it's always like family holds back.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true for us, too, for the Winklers. Family holds back except for me. I'm not kidding. I get so hungry, I'm the first online.
Really?
But that's okay.
No shame.
That's okay. And then at a certain point, you release the hounds because people have been here too long.
That's right.
And then you chase
them
off this gorgeous property.
Yeah.
And as they're running by, they're like, your trees are beautiful, like as they run into the streets of
Let's keep going.
That's right. But it's such a – you said you said, like, oh, it's so strange that, you know, I have these homes and these beautiful homes. Why is it – have you not adjusted to this yet? Because it's –
No, because I grew up in the same apartment in New York City for 27 years. At my 27th year, I came here to California to try my luck and never went home. I cannot imagine that I have owned 1, 2, 3, 4 homes and in between rented two for at least a year. That is shocking to me.
It's funny that you, this idea that you have of yourself, I mean you in the grand sense, you, but that people have of themselves is this idea of them as a kid, where it's still sort of, no matter how, where your life goes, it's still like, oh yeah, but this is weird because I'm that guy.
You know
and
what? It's
I?
True though. It's like, you know, there's a very famous, I think it's in Nashville. I think it's the Peabody Hotel.
Memphis.
Where I'm okay. From. So in the Peabody Hotel, so like at 10 o'clock in the morning, the elevator comes down, it opens, mother duck comes out.
Oh, yeah.
The baby ducks follow the mother duck into the fountain in the middle of the hotel. And then at the end of the day, they all go back. We are imprinted very young on what our experience is, and you never quite get over that.
Yeah.
And so strange for you to start succeeding so much? Did you feel weird about it or guilty or
I
odd?
Saw it as practical. What I realized was I didn't grow an inch. I didn't get any smarter. I still can't do geometry. I knew no more than I did before I was on TV in a hit show. So that thought alone kept me at bay, kept me in line, you know?
Yeah.
And then when you have children, you're really kept in line. So fame to me was practical. Here's Charlotte. Here's my dog.
Yo. Hello, pupper.
Oh, and here is Linus. No, Linus. Linus went right after.
Linus, the coffee cake is not for you.
Linus went right after the coffee cake.
But if there's nothing in there.
Now Linus.
We have to do the same thing to Kyle. Kyle!
Yeah, no, it's okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Such sweet, really pretty dogs.
Well, Labradoodle Charlotte is 13 years old.
Yeah.
And she just had an operation on her leg, so she's wearing a cone.
Which has to be the strangest experience for a dog. They do not understand why a barrier is constantly preventing them from the thing that they need to do.
That's right. From seeing, from bumping into every piece of furniture or human being.
Yep.
Now we also have a Labrador who came into our life when he was 4 months old. This tiny guy, no bigger than this microphone. And the mother grew into a Great Dane. He's 120 pounds and will eat you out of house and home. So they just came to visit.
Oh, they're very, very sweet.
Thank you.
So what was your first gig? What was your, when you first moved out here and you did, first of all, what made you say, oh, I think I can maybe try to be a performer?
Didn't say that.
Okay.
Wanted to be an actor. Studied to be an actor. Worried about being an actor. Prayed every night about working as an actor. So anxious that I had no sense of self. I was completely a ball of jelly. Somebody in New York in my agent's office at the time, Joan Scott was my first agent, and John Kimball worked in the New York office. He said, if you want to be known to New York, stay here. If you want to be known to the world, go to California. I was so scared. It took me months to build up the courage to get on that plane. I came for 1 month. At the end of the month, I had happy days.
Oh, my God.
Geez. So you just hustled right when you got here.
Hustled? I got off the plane September 18th, 1973. I took my bags and I went to my agent's office thinking I was going to go on an interview that afternoon. She said, don't you want to get acclimated? I said, I don't care 1 minute about being acclimated. I want a job. 1 week later, I went for the Mary Tyler Moore Show. That was my first job. And 2 weeks later, I went to Paramount Studios and auditioned for the Fonz. 2 weeks later, my money ran out. They called me up. They said, would you like to play this character? I flew home for Thanksgiving, 1973, flew out after Thanksgiving, having broken up with my girlfriend, Glenda Miller, at the time, and started the pilot for Happy Days.
Jeez. Did you break up with her because she was dead weight? Now you're going to be a big star?
She didn't care for pretty much anything about me.
Uh-oh.
And she even complained that my underwear was too large.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez,
you
got to
ditch that. Was Glenda Miller just Glenn Miller in a wig?
No, she was not.
Okay, yeah. All right.
She was a clothes stylist.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were an outfit that she was not particularly...
putting on. She was not putting on. Figuratively and literally.
Now, after Happy Days broke, did you get a call from Glenda like, oh, I like leather jackets? Or was she like, did she come back around?
There was an episode kind of like that, but we move on.
But it's so... I mean, first of all, it's relatively unprecedented to essentially get off the plane and then walk right in. I mean, that's amazing. That is an amazing happenstance.
Every day of my life.
But before we get into that, what happened with Happy Days, I want to hear about the Mary Tyler Moore episode. Because that's also one of my favorite.
Okay, so here is a group of people who were so tight and such a strong ensemble. The people around, the people who wrote it, the people who produced it, were the creme de la creme in Hollywood. And I got four lines. So I went to audition. I went to an office, and the producer said, look, we don't have the script, but I believe you have one line. Please pass the salt. You're sitting at a table by yourself. There's a dinner party going on. And you say, so while he's talking to me, I took this glass of pencils. I emptied it on his desk. I took one pencil, clinked it. And I said, excuse me, listen, don't rush. If you get a moment, please pass the salt. When I got back to the Sunset Marquee, with this hotel in West Hollywood, I had the job. And I went and I ad-libbed my one line into eight.
No way.
Yeah, they let me ad-lib. And then they hired me, the Mary Tyler Moore MTM mm-hmm. company. Grant Tinker was the head of the company, a great man, a loyal man. He hired me five times after that. I did the Bob Newhart show. I did the Paul Sand pilot that starred Penny Marshall.
Oh, wow.
First time I ever met Penny.
Oh, wow.
Then I got Happy Days. Then I went back. Then I did a voiceover. They called me just to do a voiceover of an attendant in an airport. And I went back and did that. It was amazing. Amazing.
So the experience of working, of shooting the Mary Tyler Moore Show, was there, you said they were a tight-knit group, but was it a warm environment?
It was a very warm environment. And they were lovely to me, even as a, an under five, which means that I had less than five lines player.
Right.
They were great. And then Ed Asner, all these years later, became my father on Royal Pains.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the dad on Royal Pains. He was my dad. And that was amazing.
Yeah.
How was Ted Knight?
Ted Knight was genuinely, instantly funny. I have worked with a lot of people, and not everybody is that funny instantly. John Ritter.
Oh, yes.
Instantly funny. Constantly funny. And I don't mean always on. I mean just whatever he did was funny. You know, John Ritter.
Of course.
Great. Yeah. So Ted Knight was great. And that character was, you know, one of the great characters that unfortunately, people don't know about now as much.
Which is too bad, because it really is. I mean, I think as the years have gone on, it's been harder and harder. The sitcom game's a little bit harder, you know.
Well, the sitcom game is harder because there's a lot that's not funny,
right?
Right now.
Yeah. But a lot that also, it's like there's so many premises have been done. It's like reinventing that over.
You know,
and over
what?
And over.
I have to say that everything has been said under the sun. I think Alexander Pope said this. We have to find a new way to say it,
mm-hmm.
to say the same thing,
right?
There's a show on, I think, Showtime called Episodes.
Yeah, Matt LeBlanc. Yeah,
right. I think that is, I look forward every week to that show. Now, what is that about? It's about a TV show that they took, Hollywood changed it, and the people around. So you know that premise. It's been done a million times.
Yeah.
It is so incredibly fresh and vibrant, that show and those people on that show.
So it's the characters, really.
It's the characters.
Yeah, it's the characters and the
writing.
The writing and then the perspective that the characters
That's
bring.
That's right. And then the actor. But the writer is the beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm.
The writer is the most important person, and yet here in Hollywood, one of the least respected people.
Yeah, you're right. Well, or at least,
They are completely changed out. They're rewritten. But the writer is the kernel. Without the word, You can't direct anything. You can't light anything. You can't act anything. You can't make anything up. You cannot create a costume. The writer is the beginning and the end of the process, I think.
Yeah.
Now you were able to stretch Please Pass the Salt, which also was reflected when you eat dinner every night to keep everyone away from you.
That's true.
Carry the salt. You were able to stretch that into 8 lines. Is it true? So here are some rumors that I had always heard about Happy Days and you and your relationship to the show. That Arthur Fonzarelli was supposed to just be in the in one episode, and then...
No. He just had like a line in every episode.
Right.
But he was in 7 out of 13 in the beginning.
So that was supposed to be that way? Because I'd always heard, he was in one episode and they loved him so much, they just, he became a mainstay.
No, I had a contract for, I believe it was 7 out of 13.
Okay.
And then after the first year, we went on the air in February. And in April, I made my first personal appearance in Little Rock, Arkansas. I got paid $1,000 to go to sign autographs for the newspaper of Little Rock, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry I forgot the name of the newspaper. I want to say it was the Constitution, but it's probably not. I went. I got off the plane at about 12:30 at night. We landed in Little Rock. 3,000 people were at the airport in poodle skirts or dungarees and t-shirts.
Yes. Jeez.
And I literally had no idea why they were there. I thought it was like a party, and they rented the space of the corridor of where you land. And then they said, no, that's for you. And it was the first time I ever lived through anything like that.
That was just a couple months after the show had been on
the air. That was a couple of months. So
the television, the power of television was...
And only 3 networks.
Yes.
Mm. There was no cable. There was only ABC, NBC, and CBS. And ABC was in the cellar. They were the bottom-rated network of America.
Wow. And was Happy Days... Was that ABC?
That was ABC.
That was ABC.
ABC. But Tuesday then, night, 8 o'clock.
But then I remember that the first, I don't know if it was the first 2 seasons or the first season of Happy Days was shot differently.
Yes.
Like it became a single camera to maybe multicam?
In 1975, we went on the air in 74. In September of 75, we did our first in front of a live audience.
Right.
And the reason we did that is because we were not rated very well. We were 48th in the country of all shows on all networks. And they were going to take us off. And I think Gary Marshall said, let's try and have an experiment. Let's do it in front of a live audience. If it doesn't work, goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to number one.
That's crazy. Because I remember recently there was that show with Christina Applegate that they tried. It was a one-camera show that they stopped and they were going to do it again.
Yes, and that was called Up All Night.
Yes, Up All Night with Will Arnett.
That's right.
And then Maya Rudolph.
That's right.
Yeah, and I remember that was such a crazy idea to me. I had no idea that had happened before.
Yes.
To such success.
What do you think it was? What do you think it was?
I don't know. All I know is maybe it was that when you are confined to the space of one soundstage, the compression of that, like if you do a Broadway play and you do it in a smaller theater, the compression of your energy off the stage across the audience and back again is enormous. If you play in a large house, then it is much more difficult. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm just talking off the top of my head. I really don't know why, but maybe it is because the humor was confined to what we could do on the one soundstage that just pumped it up better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if also it's something to do with, because when you're shooting single camera, there's the vibe of your show was such a, hey, it's like I'm seeing my family.
Right.
That you almost feel like you're a part of the household if it's multicam, because it's like, it's open and you're getting this different point of view. But single cam is very much, you're very limited to whatever the director specifically wants to show you.
Yeah, that's and very maybe, possible.
Who knows? But it worked.
It did, and thank God. And not only did it work, but it's one of them. I don't know that I got to do that in my life. That I got to be with those people. We just went 2 days ago, 3 days ago, to Gary Marshall's 80th birthday party.
Oh, my God.
Do you know? I just spoke to Anson Williams. He's written a new book. Donnie Most has become Tony Bennett.
What?
He now sings in clubs, and he is incredible.
Whatever happened to Ron Howard? He didn't really do much.
No,
after.
He did not.
Yeah.
You know what? That he was always a sloth.
Now, Clint.
Never knew his lines, never showed up on time, drunk a lot.
Not...
You could tell.
Ron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they had to get rid of him most of the way through.
No, they kept him because of his red hair.
They needed a shock of color.
I'm telling you,
yeah,
that's what it was.
They're like, people want to see gingers.
Red hair, 50s, it all went together.
Whatever happened to, wasn't there a brother, Chuck?
There was.
And he just died or went away or went to war?
The first Chuck, all of a sudden got a television show and decided, I don't want to be an actor. And he went down to San Diego, and I think he became an insurance salesman.
Wow.
So then there was a second Chuck. And the second Chuck was really terrific. But what happened is the Fonz became the older brother.
Right.
So they couldn't write two brothers. They didn't have room. They wrote themselves right out of Chuck.
Right.
So he went upstairs. He said, good night. And that was it. He never came down. So, he didn't even come down for cookies.
So there was just never. It's kind of. I think if you start exploring the lore of that world, it's just like they have this weird shut-in brother that no one talks about. But if you watch the series and imagine that he's up there being creepy,
yes.
I think it does add an interesting element.
You know, if you pass the house, and the house is in you know, that they used for the Cunningham house, is owned by a family, and they're in Hollywood. If you pass the house, you can sometimes see Chuck sitting in the window
just
in a rocking chair.
They'll ask me to come downstairs any day now.
Now, the other rumor I heard was that, were you offered a Fonzie spinoff and you said, no, I don't want to do
it? Yes, I did. First of all, they wanted to change the name of the show. Now we're 5 years in.
Right.
Then they wanted to change the show to Fonzie's Happy Days.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm going to ask you, please. I'm an actor. I'm here on the set. You're the network. You certainly have the power. I'm going to ask you, please, not to do that. It is so totally disrespectful to the ensemble of actors that I'm in. It's crazy. I don't know if I can live with it. Then they said, okay, how about if we spin you off, we give you your own show? And I thought to myself, okay, that's a great compliment. I'm getting my own show. Wow. Okay, now I'm going to go for a half an hour. And I'm going to talk to a whole new group of people that have nothing to do with my history. It would be like shooting myself in the foot. I was born on this show with these people. This is where I'm going out. Do you know what I mean?
How did you have the foresight? I mean, like, very few actors would have not. I mean, even just based on an ego decision, would be like, oh, yes, I would love to be not and not recognize, well, maybe I function best as part of this other machine.
I functioned best. I knew that I functioned best. Who was going to replace Marion Ross as my mother? Who was going to replace Ron Howard as one of the greatest acting partners I've ever had?
Yeah.
Who is going to replace Scott Baio, this young boy who came in and hit a home run?
Mm-hmm.
Or Donnie or Anson or Tom Bosley, rest his soul. The thought of it made me nauseous. Do you know?
Yeah.
And I just said, do whatever you want. I can't go.
The network must have been confounded by that. I don't understand. He's a performer. We're offering him more money. What does he want?
Right.
if you're not motivated by and this is a lot.
And I want to say right off the honestly, right? And I'm going to say this to all of you
please.
In the room yeah. right now. I love money.
All kinds.
It's I nice.
Love, you know what? As long as as you can change it into American dollars, I'm crazy about it.
It's great.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
But it's like American's your favorite.
American is at the moment is my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
If I move to another country,
who knows?
Let's talk.
Yeah. Who knows what could happen?
Really.
But
the rupee is probably you know yeah.
second. Rupee is second.
I'm not crazy about the rupee right. because you know you need a wheelbarrow for like a loaf of bread.
Right. And you don't want to have to cumbersome. Go
really?
To the store.
No, yeah. I'm a little older now.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in pushing a wheelbarrow.
What's your take on francs?
Huh?
What's your take on francs?
You mean the French franc?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I'm crazy about the franc. I love their pastry. I can't speak the language, so I probably wouldn't move there.
Yeah, because the money is meaningless to you.
But
you
I
don't
will
know
say that the French are lovely to me. I was made a commander of arts and letters. I have a medal from the government of France.
Why are we not going to France with your medal and just like walking into places and being like, give us stuff?
Yeah.
Is that like having citizenship?
Huh?
Can you essentially say you're a...
No. Mm. No. It didn't go that far.
Well, I mean, what good's the medal then?
But England, I like England. I was given the Order of the British Empire.
Jesus.
Yeah. You might not want to look me right in the eye.
Oh, that would explain all the guys with sunglasses and their fingers in their ear wandering around the property.
I'm not kidding. If I were you, I would turn my chair a little,
just a little
to your left.
How much? I don't want
to
scrape the floor.
There's a red dot on your forehead. There's a red dot on you, Jonah.
Yeah.
No, I was playing with a red pen earlier.
Oh, okay, that's what it is. But it's so interesting to...
A little Sharpie.
Yeah, just like I carried away.
And you missed the paper.
I did.
Yeah.
It was in front of me the whole time.
Yeah.
It's ironic that Jonah was using a Sharpie. It's interesting to me to make choices that are not ego based, because from my limited experience with
but
you.
But I do.
And
I
how
have.
Do you how do you take your ego out of the decision making process when
because
it's so alluring?
You know why? Because I've been burned. I was asked to direct a movie. I read it, knew I couldn't do it, didn't connect to it. But it was a major studio. It was like a big budget movie. I wanted to be a director. I had directed Billy Crystal and the late Alan King in a wonderful movie called Memories of Me.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm getting a big Hollywood movie. I said, but Henry, you don't want to do this movie. You don't know how to do this movie. It's not for you. I went, yeah, but it's a big studio. And I literally... beat my instinct to a pulp, and I was fired 13 days later.
Whoa.
13 days into the filming. I did like, you know, what is it, 6 or 11 weeks of pre-production. I was having a great old time. 13 days into filming, I got a call. Go home. And my brain turned into cream cheese. I thought my life was over.
That's incredible.
What was the movie?
It was a movie.
Okay.
Yeah, what I would like to say to your audience, though,
yes.
the people listening, when you come up against a barrier like that, when something happens to you in your life like that, and you think, oh, my God, I don't know what to do. Maybe I'm at the end and I'm just starting. It's not the end. It is not the end. You will figure out how to keep throwing yourself against the wall like pasta till you stick.
Yeah. If you,
I'm just saying.
No, yeah. Yes. As long as you can process the experience, if you don't file it as a failure, or if you file it as a...
I filed it for a long time as a failure. Honest to God, cried. I cried openly. I thank God I did not cry like in restaurants, but that was about the limit.
But at a certain point, if you're able to go, okay, so here's what I learned from this experience. I mean, you know, events and experiences are essentially neutral. It's however you're going to perceive the
You know
situation.
What? I never thought of it that way, but that you're exactly correct.
And so if you're able to, and I'm not saying that this is an easy thing to do and I'm not great at it, but it's a nice thing to say. But if you're able to look at a situation and say, well, what can I learn from this? Well, what you learned is not to let your ego make decisions for you. And maybe you learned something more about
when
directing.
Your instinct says no, do not second guess yourself.
It's at that feeling in your gut.
In your tummy.
Yeah.
As a parent, if you get a feeling that, oh my gosh, I just know my kid should not go to that party, you hang in tough. If it's work, if it's somebody you're going to date and you go, wow, I get a bad feeling, and but beautiful, like beautiful, and but wow, this is not right, go home.
I've been there.
Well, how much do you, like, how do you know that that's, like, the right move as, or...
You will know, and I know now. I will tell you, and you can take it to the bank. I'm looking you right in the eye right now, and I'm telling you, when your instinct goes off, you are right. Your instinct knows everything. Your head only knows some things.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned in my life.
Yeah. I'm always just afraid that it's, like, self-doubt.
No.
So it's stronger than
that. Different. It's different. You will know when it's your
your gut's
when the alarm goes off.
Yeah. Your gut's smarter than your brain.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree.
And a lot of times we talk ourselves, you know, the sort of the blessing and the curse, the gift of being higher on the food chain means that we can get in the way of our decision-making process more often.
Yes.
Because we can think ourselves into cul-de-sacs.
Higher on the food chain, if you make a decision against your instinct, you will be lower on the food chain.
Yes.
Very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is still very interesting to me, that, and I applaud your decision not to take the spinoff, because Happy Days spun off so many shows.
Right.
Spun off.
A lot of them failed.
But the strangest being Mork and Mindy.
Mork and Mindy was great. Laverne and Shirley, those two were great.
How did they... Well, Laverne and Shirley, amazing. And Mork and Mindy, amazing. But I was never... Even as a kid, I was like... And they didn't even really try to justify it. It was just like, why is there an alien in Milwaukee all of a sudden?
I don't...
didn't matter.
This is the myth. Yeah. He is now a wonderful director, but Gary Marshall's son, Scott, was 8 or 9 at the time. And, you know, they would come to the set. I've watched them grow up. But his son, Gary Marshall's son, Scott, said, wouldn't it be great if the Fonz was confronted by an alien?
His dad just happened to be able to make that happen.
And his dad made that happen.
Jeez.
That's incredible.
That is... the myth I know. I've never corroborated it, but I believe it to be true.
So it basically was fan fiction that was able to be materialized because it was the right person's son.
That's right.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Making it all sci-fi. All those shows are now sci-fi because of that one element.
Because of that one.
Especially, too, because Mork must have, because of him as an alien coming to the Happy Days, meaning like time travel happened, so he was able to exist. That's why Laverne Shirley happened in the future compared to Happy Days and all that stuff.
So it's
a whole sci-fi genre. And
I don't understand one word you said, but it sounds so interesting.
It does. I don't even know what I'm saying.
I'm not kidding. Laverne and Shirley was in the future?
Compared to Happy Days.
Oh, no kidding.
Think about it.
I swear to you, I never knew.
I do remember.
We went out with them on the show, and then they shot into the future to do their show?
Mork messed up
the whole timeline. Oh, my God. I've got to go to bed.
You already are in bed.
Oh, my God.
No, this might be a personal question. This might
Go
be
ahead.
A personal question.
Go ahead.
What, in your mind, when the Fonz was hooking up with all these ladies,
yes,
was he having sex with them, or was he just making out with them, or were they just hanging out?
Okay, let me think about that. In my mind now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in bed with them.
Nice.
Yeah. He was hooking up.
In the most romantic of places, the bathroom
Well, that was my office.
That was your office?
Yeah. I didn't make out with anybody in there.
No, because that's where work happens.
Because I don't know. You know those little cakes in the urinal?
Yes.
That is not a romantic smell. That's not a place you want to bring a girl, no matter how many flowers you put in there. I'm not kidding.
Certainly not in a diner.
No.
But
And you know what? I mean, think about this. Ralph Mouth made in there.
He did.
Number one in there.
Yeah, right. you don't want to.
No.
He made everything awkward.
Oh, my gosh.
He was also, unfortunately, the character.
Lori Betts, come with me into that. No.
How many of us wanted to be a Fonz but were actually a Ralph? I was.
Me.
No, you too.
I wanted to be a Fonz.
You got to be.
I got to be the Fonz, but that was play acting. That was not who I was in real life.
Well, I think it's one of the reasons why, and this is dovetailing into one of my favorite movies of all times is Night Shift.
Okay, me too.
Where you were very opposite fond.
Do you know why? Ron Howard said you can play either role. I thought, ooh, Billy Blaze is kind of like the Fonz. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play Richie. And that's what I did.
It was so good.
I played Chuck as Richie.
That's great.
And if you hadn't, then we also wouldn't have gotten Michael Keaton.
Oh, my gosh. But I'm telling you that we auditioned everybody. He came in, and within 30 seconds, Ron looked at me and went, yeah.
Wow.
And then now in Birdman, from there to Birdman.
Did you see Birdman?
Oh,
so good.
But
so
here,
good.
Let me just say, I don't know when this is going out, but for your Whiplash.
Yeah.
Oh, we were just talking about Whiplash. Over. I love Whiplash.
Oh, my goodness. Now, that's a performance that's going to be nominated. Yes. J.K. Simmons.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And did you see Foxcatcher?
Not yet.
All three.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Channing Tatum, mm-hmm. is that his name?
Yeah, Channing Tatum, Steve
Carell. Holy mackerel. You think of him one way as Mr. Mike or...
Magic Mike.
Oh, yes, right, Dancing Mike.
Yeah.
Can I just say, the man will floor you.
Really?
The man, you will drop your jaw. Then Steve Carell.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mark Ruffalo. The three of them will be nominated.
That's awesome. I can't wait to see
it. It's fun.
And it's dark.
Yeah, it looks incredibly dark. Just that in the trailer, there's that one shot of just him showing up to the practice with a gun in his hand. And
oh, my God.
It's fun seeing how much of a fan of stuff you are.
I get crazy when I meet musicians. I get tongue-tied when I meet musicians.
But they must have been tongue-tied meeting you. Like, you must have met people in the 70s that were like, you were like, I can't believe you're you. And you're like, shit, I can't believe you're
well,
you.
Well, let me just say, if that's true, David Bowie never showed it. I'm not kidding. He looked at me when Henry Howard. I thought, okay, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
I, of course, hey, listen, Major Tom, how are you? But I get crazy when I meet people that, like, I met Bruno Mars, couldn't speak.
Really?
I met Mick Jagger, made an ass out of myself.
How? How did you make an ass of yourself?
I walked up to him in a sushi restaurant. I've told this story before, but I walked up to him, and this was only less than a year ago. Walked up to him, and I went, Mick Jagger, we met once before, but and I'm so happy, and I have got every CD. I mean, I've downloaded. I saw you in concert before I left New York to come here and to do this. I love you. I think you're the great. And he looked at me and he went, Henry. And I slunk out of the restaurant. I went, okay, now, just I'm going to pull myself together and walk out the door.
Oh, he wasn't screwing with you. He was just being sort of.
He was Henry. Okay.
Oh.
Okay. I've just made a complete ass out of myself.
No.
And he didn't like. It's just like
well,
the
he
fact
was
that
with
even
his girlfriend.
Yeah, but he didn't even like. There was no polite. It was just like the fact that he barely did anything.
Well, I thought that perhaps I should have just nodded.
No, yeah. He was wrong. You were right.
I should have just winked.
Next time,
that was the second time I met him. I met him on a plane going to Miami, where the Happy Days ball team was playing. At the Dolphins stadium.
Yeah.
You know,
the third
softball.
Time you meet him, I have a suggestion, and you don't have to do it.
No, I'm going to, the third time, I'm going to send him a note.
No.
Just go, I'm really excited that you're in the same restaurant.
Here's what you do. You see him in the restaurant. You walk into the restaurant, put on the leather jacket, hit the jukebox, and you just look at him and walk out.
I start dancing.
Yeah.
Got it.
You hit the jukebox, it comes on. And then I don't see any other way that you can meet Mick Jagger
the
next time.
I'm going to do it.
But I think you have experiences like that, and it's also part of the reason.
Oh, my gosh. My grandson just walked in with my daughter.
Hello.
That's Zoe, and my wife, Stacy, and ladies and gentlemen, Ace in the house.
We're with the government. Yeah, hi. We're just talking to your dad about
stuff. Sorry, the traffic was too bad. We had to come here.
I'm so glad you did.
Come on.
It's real bad out there, isn't it?
It's violent.
Oh.
It's the end of the world. Are you hungry for
I love you, Ace.
He's a redhead.
He's a redhead, like his mommy, like his grandma. And then we have two granddaughters, India Bell and Lulu. Lulu was here this afternoon.
I saw the name on the chalkboard out there.
Yeah.
So Lulu. There's nothing.
Oh, Elton John?
Yes.
Oh, man.
I went up to him. I said, John, I'm crazy about your...
It's Elton. It's Reginald, actually.
I'm going to walk away now.
No, but it probably made you more sensitive to people coming up to you that you would be very accommodating.
I didn't need that kind of sensitivity training.
Oh.
I'm pretty good with people come up to me.
Yeah.
I was just mortified by my brain and my mouth. I'm not kidding.
I think you should have gone easier.
But I do love you. I love meeting musicians.
Were there guest stars on the show that you were you like, oh, I want to meet this person. We should get them on the show.
The Lone Ranger.
Oh.
I have a silver bullet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Howdy Doody. I remember the Howdy Doody one
where they dressed Richie up like Howdy Doody.
Hello.
Yes.
And I was in the peanut gallery as a little boy and went home with a jar of Ovaltine.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Unbelievable. Buffalo Bob was on our show. Phil Silvers. You know who came to visit?
No.
John Lennon.
When?
Yes. Came to visit early on because the picture I have is of me in a cloth jacket before I got to wear leather.
Right.
And his son, Julian, who was 8 or 9 at the time.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Ringo came with Keith Moon, the drummer.
What?
Who
yes.
Fortunately passed away, the Who's drummer.
Wow.
What? They came to set?
They came to set.
Just to hang out?
To hang out, say hi.
Was he? What was
Michael
Keith
Jackson. Doing? I came around the corner to my dressing room. Michael Jackson was sitting there, and he was doodling on my script.
Oh.
I have his doodle.
You saved it?
I said, oh. Believe me.
How old
I'm a
he?
Hoarder. I think I'm
yeah.
a hoarder.
Yeah.
I save everything. Yeah.
That's been. You should have a museum.
Hank Aaron?
Yeah.
Hank wow. Aaron came.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
714.
Yeah.
So at this time where you go to the airport in Little Rock and a few months after you get this job and there's 3,000 people there and they're
yes.
screaming and you're feeling
yes.
this and it's like, how do you stay grounded and how do you just sort of not flip out?
I never was able to make the connection that this was happening because of me. I thought, oh, they like the character, but I never absorbed it as I walk on water.
Mm-hmm.
I am really an important person. That never, ever entered my consciousness.
Was it the respect for the craft that you had and like the writers
no,
and the...
I think it was the lack of self that I didn't have. That I couldn't make the connection that I've never been treated this way. I didn't do well in most things growing up. You know, that's why I now write the books for kids about learning challenges. Why I talk to children in 3 or 4 countries about all things are possible. And it doesn't matter how difficult school is for you.
So you had, is this true that you had dyslexia but didn't know until you were about 30?
31.
31.
My stepson, Jed, was tested, and everything that they said about him was true about me.
And you,
and
oh.
now 1 out of 5, and, you know. And we don't do much about it, and the world doesn't, but certainly America doesn't. I figured out because children don't vote, so we don't really have to do much for them. We just talk about them,
mm-hmm.
just about how important they are as the future. We just don't have to educate them. Do you know?
Yeah, but at that time. I mean, you must have been working. But I mean, you were working. That was happy days.
I was working, but I was always covering. I was always embarrassed.
How were you covering?
Well, because I couldn't read. So I would improvise. I learned to improvise to save my life. Wow. You know? And I would go into an audition. I would memorize as quickly as I could. And what I didn't remember from the page, I made up.
That was your survival mechanism.
That was my my survival mechanism.
And did anyone on the show know at the time?
No, because I didn't know. What they did know was that on Monday morning when we read the script around the table for the producers, that I stumbled over every word and, you know, constantly had to go back and start again. They knew that.
So when you were growing up, what did you think it was?
Well, when I was growing up, I was just told I was stupid.
Oh, Jesus.
But children today, they are still, you know, there are some teachers who are now trained and realize that there are kids, one out of five children learn differently. But do you know that testing in the third and fourth grade is how they decide how many prison cells they're going to construct?
What? Jeez.
In England also. It is true. It's a qualified, quantified fact.
Holy, and you're nodding, Kyle. You've heard of this. And it's just based on the aptitude tests?
And because, you know, and I say this all the time, but a teacher has 30 kids in the class, has to teach the fastest kid and the slowest kid the same exact information in the same amount of time. Somebody is not getting it.
Sure.
Somebody is falling through the cracks. And a child who falls through the cracks has to feel good about themselves in some way, and some turn it negatively, and some, you know, just manage to work their way through.
So when you first discovered, when you had this moment, oh, wow, okay, yeah. There's this. What, at that time, what tools were in place to help you? I mean, did your life change almost immediately?
No. First thing was, I was angry beyond red. I saw purple because all of that yelling and screaming in my house and grounding and punishment and not being able to watch television. And when I was growing up, television was tubes. So if I didn't turn it off in enough time before my parents came home from wherever they went on Saturday night, they only had to touch the top of the television to know if I had it on or not.
Oh, yeah.
Because they could feel the heat. That all of that was for nothing, because this brain was not going to get it, you know, come hell or high water, no matter how many tutors I had, no matter how long I sat at my desk.
Your ability to survive certainly contributed to a lot of the things in your life.
Yes, the will.
The will.
The will. I now know that one of the most important components to maintain in your child is their will. Every kid knows what they're great at. You just have to ask a kid, what are you great at? They'll tell you, I'm great at running. One kid said, I'm great at being myself. I'm great at math. I'm great at the violin. I'm great at science. I'm great at painting. Football. They all know. And if this country is going to maintain greatness, we need every child to be on all eight cylinders in what they are great in order to survive. And not, you know, there's a great story that educational theorist tells, Sir Ken Richardson. A little kid is sitting there. She's in the second grade. She's drawing. Teacher comes up and says, what are you drawing, Sally? I'm drawing God. The teacher said, oh, well, you know, nobody knows what God looks like. Sally looked up and said, in a minute they will. And that, to me, is the microcosm of the journey. Our children know, and we educate them almost out of themselves into their head. So we take all of their creativity, all of their whatever they do great, and we just squeeze it like an orange in a juicer, and get it all out, and then we leave them with like a little pulp.
To try to force them into a system or force them into to keep them from being great.
Right. But and it's not even, they're not even, I don't think they're thinking that we're not going to let them be great, but it's going to be easier for us as adults.
Right.
You know, and then you go to West Virginia and you go to the Ripley school system and they're the parents, the teachers, the students, everybody, the librarians are all reading the same book so they all can talk about something.
Yeah.
If you listen very carefully, my grandson is 2 years old playing the drums.
That's a drum kit in there?
I do. We have like this big.
That's adorable.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's a lot of patience.
He's going to be a musician, and then you're going to be nervous to talk to him.
It takes a lot of patience. Yeah.
That's what's going to happen.
Are you going to do some J.K. Simmons whiplash stuff to him if it doesn't get any better?
You know what? I walk in there, and I slap my head. I say, are we keeping the rhythm? Are you keeping the rhythm? No!
So you wrote this series of books, which basically are designed for children
to make them laugh.
But also, if they have difficulty learning or reading, you said it's a very specific font.
The newest series that we have written is called Here's Hank. Mm-hmm. Here's Hank. And he's in the second grade, and the publisher, Grosset, found a new font designed by a dad in Holland for his children who are dyslexic. And it literally makes it easier to scan the words across the page. But our books are comedies first. I mean, that is hands down. They are to make the kid laugh. And then some children write and they say, how did you know me so well?
Oh.
You know? So it's great. It's great. I'm very, outside of my children and my grandchildren, I am proudest of the books. And I am crazy about the fact that I get to live my dream as an actor, even now, after all this time.
What is the weirdest thing? Because at the height of Fonz fame, they were basically like, well, we could put this guy on anything and people are going to want it because it's him. The weirdest thing?
They wanted me to sing on an album. They wanted me to make an album. I said, I don't sing. I cannot sing. So they said, don't worry about it. You'll sing one note at a time and we'll piece it together. Geez. I said, I don't think so. I don't think I'm going to do that. I don't think I can do that. I'm not. Then they said, okay, can we put together a compilation of your favorite 50s songs? I said, well, that's closer. And then there's a big album with my face on it that people bring to me and I sign.
Oh, wow.
That's incredible. Were you comfortable? I mean, I'm sure you've been asked a million times that I apologize, but I just didn't hear the answer. When you jump over the shark in Arrested Development.
Yes.
Was the most layered nod to such a specific pop culture thing that is, were you cool? I mean, like, because you seem to have a sense of humor about stuff. So did you think it was funny? Did you get it? Or are you like, oh, come on, give.
You mean when they came up with the phrase?
Yes.
Oh, no, I knew what the phrase. I knew what they were talking about, except that we were number one for years after I jumped the shark. And then on Arrested Development, I jumped the shark a second time. So I'm the only actor in the world who's jumped the shark twice, you know? I literally jumped the shark. I did all the water skiing except for the jump. They hired a stuntman from Florida.
Oh, wow.
A water skiing stuntman to do that.
You got to get them to put it into Children's Hospital and do it a third time.
The new season is coming, I think, in March.
Oh, yeah?
I'm telling you, they have me doing the craziest things.
This might saying be, a lot.
This might be my favorite season of all time.
Oh, nice.
I got to be in one of the episodes. I got to be John Cleese in Fawlty Towers.
That's I'm podcasting Middleman. Him tomorrow.
Will you send him my respect?
Do you know him?
I never met him.
Oh, me neither.
Maybe I shook his hand once. But we watched every episode when Max, my son, who is now a director and a writer here in California, he was four, and he loved it. And all of a sudden, I had a friend from Germany who said, hey, my sister and her new husband are coming to Los Angeles. And I said, invite them to my house. Tell them they're coming to my house for dinner. We sat at the dinner table, and all of a sudden, my four-year-old comes in. Don't mention Zavol. Don't mention Zavol. And his hand is out, and he's goose-stepping. I swear to you, their eyes, you know, like on Halloween, you wear those eyes on like eyes. Slinky.
Yes.
Their eyes became slinkified. And then I had to explain to them in broken English, in broken German, because my parents were German, that he's joking. He's kidding. It's a program.
Was there any way of backpedaling out of that with the German folks? Did they understand? No, they didn't. It was not.
It was horrible. Then I served them. I served them Haagen-Dazs bars.
I'm so sorry.
Oh my God! I'm so sorry. Please enjoy your ice cream.
Is there any? But you really should watch Fawlty Towers because it's a great show.
Yeah. Oh my God! But I got to be John Cleese in that great episode. When it runs back and forth out of the kitchen, you know,
yeah.
And there's nothing to eat, and he is yelling at the chef who doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So was Happy Days 12 seasons?
No, 10.
10 seasons.
10 seasons, but we did 2 seasons in 1 year. We just kept going.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then were you relieved or was it?
You know, it was time.
Yeah.
It was time. It was time. Here's the next lesson that I learned. You have to know, if nothing else, you have to know what you want. If you do not know what you want, you will move in a circle, like a motorboat that just keeps turning in the water around and around and around. I'm telling you, it was psychically painful because I had just lived my dream and I had lived it to the nines, and now it was over and I didn't know what to do. I was immobile. I was petrified. I sat in my office at Paramount and I knew I was smart enough. You don't know what you want. You don't know what you're doing. Don't do anything. I just sat there. Started to produce. Didn't like producing much, but we did MacGyver and Sightings and, you know, a show for the Disney Channel. And I had a great time doing that. I mean, I was fortunate to do that. I didn't have a great time. I was fortunate.
Right.
Directed. Never really got in the directing game. Never really got in the club. I directed television, I directed commercials, I directed 2 features, I directed Dolly Parton's first television movie. Wow. But it was like I was pulling a lawnmower. You know, you pull when you used to pull that lawnmower and it just wouldn't kick over. That was my directing career. 10 years of really not being able to get work as an actor. Started to happen again in 1991. And then in 2003, we started writing these books, and now we've written 29 novels.
Wow. Was the acting stuff just because they were like, oh, well, you're this one character,
yes,
and we can't make you. No one else is going to believe you. Was anything else?
Yeah, I was typecast. I did everything I could to fight it, but it is bigger than you are. So then it is up to you to make yourself into Mercury so that you can slip through the smallest hole in the dike. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
You find the way across over to the other side. And only you can do that. You know, you can't look for help because most of the time you call people and you say, oh, my gosh, I'm really stuck. Can I come talk to you? And they'll talk to you and then you go home.
Yeah.
So it really is up to you and your will. That's why, again, I mention will. that will let you survive or not.
Do you think some of it has to do with, because, you know, you made a point that I 100% agree with, which is know exactly what you want. Most people don't know what they want.
And, it's the key.
And but I think
it's the key.
I think it could go back to what you were saying earlier about finding that piece of our childhood where you go, what are you good at? Oh, I'm a good runner, or I'm a good this. Like getting back to that place where we're, you know, just digging down and stripping away all of the rejection and the cynicism and all of the, oh, you, I can't do, I can't,
yes,
I can't, I can't,
I
finding that thing.
I agree with you 100%. And I'll tell you, I'll tell you something else that I think it is. It's the will. It is the finding what you're great at. And then you find something and you go, wow, you know, I've always wanted to do that. But no, I probably wouldn't be good. I shouldn't try. Nah, that's, I don't have time. Not the right. It's the courage to say, yes, I'm going to try.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't say, yes, I'm going to try, these children's books would not exist.
Right.
I would, it was very easy for me to say, you know what? I can't do that. It's not in my wheelhouse. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not going to do it.
Is there anything that you never did that you still want to do or wish that you had done? Just if that you were anything you were afraid of,
no,
that you didn't try?
No, I would like to. I'm afraid of everything.
Really?
Yeah. I did a movie in 1979 for ABC. I did a television movie where I played Scrooge.
Mm-hmm.
I almost talked myself out of that. And I stepped over the line and took the plunge. And, you know, I'm so proud that I did it. You know, I thought, oh, my God, Alistair Sims, all these people who played Scrooge, what the hell do you think you're doing, Henry? So you'd go and you find out what you're doing, and you just try it. Neil Simon called me up and said, I want you to read, just read a play for me so I can hear it. Down at the Music Center, my worst nightmare, reading off a page.
From Neil Simon.
Neil Simon. Yeah. Oh, my God. I found every reason to say no, and I realized I now, you know what, just shut up, Henry, and get your ass down there and do it. You know? Or don't you dare comb your hair in the mirror again. Don't you look at yourself again. I went down there. Make a long story short, we were on Broadway for 9 months.
Wow.
But I was this close to saying, you know what? I'm not available.
So it's not so much, I mean, it's okay to be afraid of things, but it's what you do that.
That's the key.
So how do you push through it?
By saying, I'm going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, you just put one foot in front of the other and you find yourself where you're supposed to be. I am no different than anybody else. I just know what I want, and I really want to continue doing it while I'm still standing.
Yeah.
And it works for anybody. It works for anybody. I know that to be true. I know that. Hold on. Stace?
Yeah.
Could I ask you to close the door, honey? There is no hall door.
That's a fair.
How about the door that leads to the hall?
No, there is no door.
No. My wife just closed the child gate. That's not going to work. No, that didn't work, honey. I can still hear you chattering. Are you talking to the gate?
It's amazing. How long have you been married? There it is.
Okay.
Next time on the Winklers.
Yes. The only thing is, she's on this side of the door.
Yes.
You see, that's the only thing.
And the child gate just prevented the child from getting...
from falling down.
But not...
the stairs.
The sound does not follow the same rules as children.
No.
No. How long have you been married?
36 years.
And what have... first of all, amazing. Congratulations.
Amazing. Yeah, it's great.
And I myself am amazing.
So I can see.
You know what it is?
What is it?
It's living in separate homes. And that really is the key. You know? And you kind of you drive over every once in a while.
And oh, say perfect. Hi.
That's all I've ever dreamed of.
Yeah, you pick up your mail and you keep going. you keep moving.
Yeah. Like a shark.
I'm telling you, never sleep. Never sleep in the same place two nights in a row. Okay.
treat them like Mick Jagger. Just give them a nod every once in a while.
Oh, I'm not kidding. Mick, I'm nodding.
Henry.
You don't have to say you're nodding. You can just nod.
Henry.
Were you guys, was there a ton of improv in Night Shift? Were you guys improvising a lot?
No. Now, it was written by two greats. It was written by Babalu Mandel and Lowell Gans, who ran Happy Days for 7 years. Mm-hmm. So these guys are still to this day some of the best script doctors in the world. We were on the subway. A saxophonist came up and started to blare in my face as the character Chuck in the movie. We break for lunch. I'm supposed to give him some money. I thought, you know what? There's got to be something funnier than he's right in my face. I really want him to leave. I'm a little intimidated. What do I do? I don't want to just give him money. We're at lunch. Michael Keaton said, write him a check. I ran to Ron. I said, I think we solved them. And he said, okay, let's do it. So there was that, you know, and Michael just was this light, you know?
But the character of Chuck, and I know the scene you're talking about where the guy's like, you're like, I don't, and then you just start writing. Is Chuck close to who you are? Because Chuck's character was so much he would try to make people happy at the expense of his own happiness. Like, he would help people.
Chuck is closer to me than the Fonz.
But The perfect synthesis of you guys. Why did that group not get together again and do something else?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But really, people ask now. They say, "Well, you know, with you two." I don't know.
I just met him at New York Comic Con. I moderated a panel for Birdman, and he was so lovely and engaging and, you know, maybe it's time.
Well, you know what? Also, he is. Look how he's got to know how lucky he is that this magnificence came into his lap.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If you're not grateful about that, then you're never going to be.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah. And, you know, Ed Norton was great in that movie.
Yeah.
But fantastic. The star of that movie, I think, is the director.
The movie is the star of the movie.
The movie is the star of the movie.
Yeah. And hopefully people, because I kept, you know, at Comic-Con, I was like, guys, it's not a superhero movie. Like, I was trying to tell them, like, it's not a superhero movie. It's a movie, but you should see it. You absolutely have to see it.
Yeah, really.
So what's left? What else?
You know what's left is, I don't know what's left. I just hope that it is whatever, from whatever time I have now until what's left, I hope is as full as it's been. That's all I can ask for. I get to travel a lot. I get to speak to all of these wonderful children all over the world. I get to speak to adult groups. I get to act. I get to write these wonderful books. Which, can I just say, I have no shame, I think are really great Christmas gifts.
Yes, it's the holiday season.
It's the holiday season. Hank Zipser or Here's Hank. Gosh, they will make your kid happy. Or any kid that you know.
Yeah, because
who's
this one?
This is Scruffy.
This is a third new dog.
Scruffy.
This is a third.
Hi, Scruffy.
Lightning.
Scruffy is...
Scruffy is a brand new puppy. Scruffy!
Scruffy's amazing!
This is my son-in-law!
Scruffy! Scruffy!
Oh, Scruffy.
So now we've had...
No, no apology. You can't... You cannot contain Scruffy. Scruffy is lightning in a bottle.
Scruff.
Oh. Wow.
Scruff. Yes, my baby girl.
What a sweet...
Yes, my baby girl.
What a sweet dog.
Oh, she's the best. She's the best. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are we?
Wonderful. Your son is upstairs.
He's quite a drummer, by the way.
He is.
Yeah.
He was. He's fantastic.
I agree. I'm heavily biased. So. All right.
Bye, Scruff. As he bounces on his on her back legs,
you know what I love about,
out of the room.
What I love about, because a lot of podcasts we do are in a little studio space.
Yeah.
But it's really nice just sort of getting a sliver of what your life is like, which is very...
Crowded. It's very crowded.
You gotta cut a lot of this loose, man. You should get an apartment in Hollywood and just go live,
you,
live the life.
I got my own house.
No, but it's just the idea of you, just how family centric everything just sort of swirls around. Yeah.
But it's really enriching, you know, especially you know, for when you have grandchildren, it is different. You know, people always say, oh, well, you know, the great thing about grandchildren is you get them and you have them and then you give them back. And that, I think, is just a silly thing because they are just tender and fun and enlightening. You know, it's great.
I think after this podcast, everyone's going to want to come over and have coffee cake with
you.
So
you're all welcome.
Just know that there's.
Could you stop at a bookstore along the way?
And pick up.
I knew there was something to the coffee cake. You piece of shit!
But you know what, though? You know what? I have to pay for that coffee cake in some way.
Yeah, seriously, Jonah.
You know the store doesn't take. You know doesn't take like. You know, you give them like a baseball card,
or
if you give them a Hank Aaron card, I'm sure. Yeah.
A Hank Aaron card. I wish I had one.
By the way, what I worked at, I used to work at K-Rock in the 90s.
Yeah.
And my favorite, like they had these drops of basically people coming in and going, my name is so-and-so, and you listen to the world famous K-Rock. My absolute favorite one, and I played it over and over again when I was on the air from midnight to five, was you. And I guess you would come in and they had asked you, like, what's your Christmas wish?
Yeah.
And you go, hi, this is, I remember it word for word. Hi, this is Henry Winkler. And if I have one wish for Christmas, it's quit calling me fucking Fonzie, okay? And that was the drop. And I didn't expect it.
Right.
And and even when I did, it made me laugh every single time.
We had a great time together, though, because I would be on that show a lot, the morning show.
Yeah.
You know,
Kevin and Bean.
And then Bean, how about this for technology?
Yeah.
Bean is not even in the state.
Really weirded me out when I went in there and you just hear the voice and they still have like a dynamic.
It's amazing.
It's insane.
They're talking to each other like they're next door to each other.
They're great. They're so good. And such, I dig those guys.
Yeah.
I've
really
known them forever.
Yeah. It's
and
wonderful.
They're just nice guys.
They were wonderful to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as we're sort of wrapping out the podcast and wrapping out the year, what are you thankful for this year?
You know, one of the things that I've thought about is that we used to say, "Wow, the world is so small; it's getting smaller," and now the thought of it getting smaller is so dangerous. We are a plane ride away from a plague. We're a plane ride away from terrorists. There are wars going on. There are new wars starting. We never finish the war phase. So, you know, some of these children are going to grow up. And when is it that we are really going to just go, you know what? Why don't you live over there? We'll live over here. And for both of us, them to us and us to them. And just get along, you know?
Correct, Amundo.
That sounds a little trite, but it's like, oh, my God, we can only go into a tornado.
Yeah.
You know, that is just going to sweep the world up into I don't know what dust. You know, the next world war is going to be about fresh water. California is, we're pumping water out of the reserves underground. It will take hundreds of years to replace that water. There is no water coming. But I know where there's the greatest black and white cookie.
What?
That I've ever had in America. Can I just say Bee's Bakery in Reseda?
It's in Reseda.
Yeah. The best black and white cookie in America.
That was the most perfect ending to the podcast. Would you please, we say it, we tell people to enjoy their burrito at the end of the podcast. We say enjoy your burrito.
Enjoy your burrito.
It sounds so nice coming from you.
Of course, yeah. It will give me gas.
Yeah. But you'll enjoy it before
but
that
I'm
happens.
But I'm going to love it while it's going down.
And watch exactly. It and follow it up with a black and white cookie.
There you go.
At Bee's?
At Bee's Bakery.
In Reseda, California.
Hello.
You got stock in Bee's?
No. It's just I've been going there for years.
Oh, really?
Like 30.
Wow.
Yeah. Sometimes my birthday cake is that black and white cookie, except bigger.
A big giant cookie.
A big giant black and white cookie.
Done.
Yeah. But it's the greatest black and white cookie ever. And can I just say thank you for coming to my house?
Of course.
Of course.
And what a pleasure to
chat
with
you. It's an honor. I didn't want to eat it while we were talking, but now I'm going to enjoy some coffee cake. And it's good. My birthday's Sunday, so I'm having a birthday party tonight.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Oh, my God. Do you have any idea when I was a kid if I thought the Fonz would say happy birthday to me?
Wait a minute. Arthur.
Yeah, what do you want?
You know what? Could you just say happy birthday on the air?
Do I have to?
Could you just do it as a favor to me?
Yeah, right. Who's it to?
This gentleman here sitting in the white,
in the purple shirt. All right, he's wearing purple, you know that. Hey, happy birthday. I'm not kidding, and like many, many more. What is your name?
It's Chris.
Chris, yeah. You ride bike?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right, what kind?
Just a Schwinn.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's like really a pussy.
Thank you, Fonzie.
Bye.
That was an even better ending than the black and white cookie.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.